Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, protesters crash a meeting of the Utah County Commission to try to prevent a state mask mandate in schools. That protest was one of two that took place in northern Utah on Wednesday as the state looks at reopening schools in the midst of a pandemic. Utah Governor Gary Herbert announces changes to the state's COVID-19 risk guidelines, a change that will allow Salt Lake City schools to join the rest of the state in reopening, and what we know and what we don't know about some of the long-term impacts of the novel coronavirus. On the phone to discuss this with me, I have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner, and good morning and welcome to you, Courtney. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle is with us as well. And hi, George. Good morning.
How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you. I hope you're doing well as well. A little bit later, we will hear from the Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson on the impacts of coronavirus long-term symptoms. That's coming up later on the show, so stay tuned for that. And listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also always tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Courtney Tanner, I'm not exactly certain how to set this one up. Your story was the first one that I saw published on this topic, but it has since been picked up by a lot of national press. You were in attendance for a meeting of the Utah County Commission on Wednesday. That meeting was overtaken, I guess you could say, by people concerned, irate even, about masks, specifically about masks and kids in schools. Courtney, first off, the meeting itself was a regular commission meeting, but masks, they were on the agenda. So how did this rally, this takeover of that meeting materialize? How did it come together? Who organized it, and why did they organize it?
Sure. Yeah, it was organized largely by Commissioner Bill Lee. He's a Republican member of this three-person Utah County Commission. And he had drafted this proposal to ask for what he calls, quote, compassionate exemption from the state's requirement that all K-12 students and staff in the schools wear masks this fall when schools reopen. And so he had that on the agenda to vote on, and then he also organized this kind of gathering. He didn't really want to call it a rally, but this gathering that turned into a rally before the commission meeting. And about 150 people showed up to that.
Hmm. And that was in advance of this commission meeting on Wednesday afternoon. Lee wants to get this compassionate exemption from the school mask mandate. The mask mandate comes from Governor Gary Herbert for school students, again, not for the general public, but for students who are going to K-12 schools. It says they need to wear a mask. And so these parents and community members came to say no to that, but they wanted to say it to their county commission. Can you talk a little bit about the meeting that did happen outside of the commission? You talked about Lee and who he was and organizing this, but what was the scene there? What were people doing outside as they waited to go into the commission?
So they met outside of the Provo courthouse kind of in the afternoon, and it kind of started, I mean, there was this large gathering of people kind of clinging to the shade. It was really hot. And then Commissioner Bill Lee walks out, and he actually was wearing a mask when he walked out, and he said that it was required for being in the building. And the crowd immediately starts chanting, "Take the mask off, take the mask off." And so he does, and then he kind of addresses the crowd. But it was this huge group of people. We're estimating more than 150. Some of them were carrying signs. One of them said, "Don't smother the children." Another one said, "Like kids be kids, no masks." And so, you know, it was pretty volatile, I guess you
sure.
could say. There were a couple.
Yeah, I was going to say there were some people who came to support the use of masks as well. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. So some counter protesters or pro mask people showed up, and one man had this sign that said wearing a mask is an act of compassion. And the group kind of yelled and screamed at him when he held up his sign. You know, they responded that it was an act of submission. And they said, "Jesus gives us a choice. Mandates are against freedom." you guys are at the wrong rally. And so it got pretty tense. It got heated. There was a family there, a mom and a dad and their kids, and they were all wearing masks to support masks. And a woman shouted, like, get that mask off that poor little boy. So there definitely were some clashes outside.
Wow. I feel like it's important to say before we get too far into this that that scientists and public health officials, infectious disease specialists, they say that mask wearing prevents the spread of disease. And in fact, I have a clip that I want to play. This is Dr. Tom Miller, chief medical officer with University of Utah Health at this week's COVID-19 briefing. Just take a quick listen to his comments on this.
For 140 years, we've known that masks have prevented the spread of disease, and that's why surgeons wear them. You would not likely go to see a surgeon for an operation without them wearing a mask.
I'll point out that Dr. Miller also said that shaming or blaming people isn't going to help, but that, you know, people should lead by example and wear masks in public. Courtney, I want to turn to what happened inside the meeting now, just in case, in case somebody hasn't read your story yet. And I also just recommend that people check out Tribune photographer Rick Egan's photos on this story. They show what I'm about to ask about. Courtney, the way that things had been set up inside of the commission chambers was that there were measures in place to ensure social distancing. The photos, Rick Egan's photos, they don't show that. I guess I'm wondering if you could paint the picture inside of the commission chambers, which is something that your article does very well as well.
Right. Definitely check out Rick's photos. They are a sight. So inside the commission chambers, it's a fairly small boardroom, but they had taped off chairs, you know, so that people would not kind of congregate in large groups. And so when people actually came into the room, they started kind of tearing that tape off, and they crowded into the chairs anyway. And they, you know, they were lined up against the walls, and there were just people everywhere. They had an overflow room, but not very many people wanted to go to that. They wanted to be in the actual chambers. So it was about 100 people crammed into a pretty small room.
Because of that, one of the commission members, Tanner Ainge, called for the meeting to be suspended, and that happened, right?
Right. So he, as soon as the commissioner sat down, Commissioner Tanner Ainge said, you know, I'm not going to support so many people in this room, not social distancing, not wearing masks. You know, this goes against every health guideline. So he made a motion to kind of suspend the rules and adjourn the meeting with the intention of hearing the proposal another day, you know, in a bigger space where they could actually, like, mandate social distancing. And then the board's third member, Nathan Ivey, voted in favor of that, and Bill Lee, obviously, against. So they did adjourn the meeting, you know, about a minute in on that 2-1 vote.
However, so they adjourn the meeting, but they after that, Tanner Ainge leaves, that commission member. It's not an official meeting at that point, and then the public is allowed to comment anyway. And a lot of people, the bulk, of course, arguing against masks. Could you highlight some of what was said during those public comments to just the commissioners who were sitting there?
Yeah. So, you know, it ranged a pretty wide gamut, but you're right. Most of them were anti-mask. So there were some teachers who said, you know, I'm not going to be able to connect as well with my students if everyone's in a mask. They're not going to be able to see, like, my facial expressions. I'm not going to be able to see theirs. Others said that they know of kids that have, like, anxiety or asthma who wouldn't really be able to comfortably wear a mask. There were more than that. You know, some said that the virus isn't real anyway. And there are 5,600 cases in Utah County. And then, you know, some compared it to the flu or heart disease. One mother suggested that masks cut down on a person's oxygen. And you mentioned Dr. Tom Miller earlier. He said that's not the case. There's nothing that actually suggests that. They kind of ran the gamut. But a lot of folks, you know, said that their issue is that they feel that this tramples on their constitutional rights, that they have the freedom to choose whether or not they wear a mask and whether or not their kids wear a mask, and they didn't appreciate a mandate that told them what to do.
Were they confronted at all? I mean, I don't know if there was, I guess there were people who testified in favor of mask wearing, but I'm wondering if the parents who were who were there rallying against masks, if they were confronted at all by people who could speak about the benefits and the science, and not just individual benefits, but the, you know, the sort of broader public health benefits, you know, someone like a Dr. Tom Miller, or was it more of an echo chamber, I guess, is what I'm asking?
There were a few folks who spoke who were pro-mask. A couple of them were teachers who said, you know, I don't feel safe returning to the classroom without students in masks. One of them was starting her first year of teaching this fall, and her husband's also a teacher. So essentially, they're both in high schools, and she's like, we're going to pass hundreds of students between the two of us every day. But it was mostly, I would say, you know, teachers that spoke in support of masks, and there weren't very many. About 30 people spoke, and about 3 were in favor of masks.
Yeah, I mean, the teacher, you talked about this teacher and her husband. I guess it's the teacher was commenting on you know, behalf of herself and her husband, who is also a teacher, and saying that she wasn't comfortable, you know, going to her classroom without people adhering to this mask mandate. Is that a fair depiction of her comments? Yeah.
So she describes, you know, mask might be like a little inconvenient, but she's like, you know, this is proven, as you said, as Dr. Tom Miller said, this is proven to reduce the spread of COVID-19. And she said, you know, I'll just feel safer. I'll just feel more comfortable in the classroom with masks on everyone.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 to offer your questions and comments. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Columnist and editorial page editor George Pyle, I've kept you silent until now. Pretty soon we need to head to a break, and then we'll move northward to another rally up here in Salt Lake City. But on this meeting, I don't know, there's a sort of kind of parallel understanding of the world at play that doesn't, I guess, accept the, you know, the evidence that the health officials are putting out there. And I don't mean that as an insult. It's just sort of the reality of America in 2020. I'm rambling, George. What are your thoughts on what's happening in Utah County?
Yeah, rambling is my job.
Go ahead.
I mean, the doctor is right in that if you try and just shame people or belittle people, it probably isn't effective in the long run. But boy, that's hard to resist. These people are on some alternate wavelength. I mean, there's a little bit of a continuum. There's the idea that you know, people have rights and people have agency and people have choice, over to the just the ridiculous things that the virus isn't real, it's a hoax, it was made in a lab. Well, even if it was made in a lab, it's still dangerous and you should still do things to protect yourself from it. And these are just ridiculous ideas. I mean, it's made Utah look stupid globally. I mean, this thing isn't just all over the country on the national networks, on CNN, on NBC. It's on the BBC. It's in the Daily Mail in London. It's all over the place. And, you know, they don't even have to try and spin it to make us look bad. They just say what happened and we look bad. It's a difficult position for our leaders to be in. Governor Herbert has, you know, tried to explain to people what's important, and he's wearing a mask, but he doesn't seem to have the political will or thinks he has the political might or capital to actually impose mandates. Because I guess Utahns don't like mandates, and there is a certain element of that's been expressed that the more you mandate something, the more people will want to resist it, just on general principle. But I don't think there's any question that everybody wearing masks is the best thing we have right now, because we don't have a vaccine yet and we don't have a silver bullet treatment where you can just take a pill and get over it. We don't have those things. And so the next best thing, and in the case of a pandemic, usually always the best thing is not to treat it, but to prevent it. And the way to prevent it, the best way we have, is for everybody to wear masks. And yes, it can be uncomfortable and it can be difficult to enforce. And you have fidgety kindergartners and you have defiant teenagers. And so it will be difficult. And if it becomes, and you don't want the kind of thing where you have the SWAT team come in if a kindergartner takes off his mask to blow his nose. But it should be a mandate. It should be in all the schools. If you really have a situation with, you know, anxiety, asthma, something where you truly can't wear a mask, and there are very few cases where that's true, then you should just stay home.
George,
because you're not safe, and you're not, and other people aren't safe.
What about the idea, George, though, that that this is, you know, an individual, personal choice? I should get to make this decision for myself and my family. That's the argument that we're hearing from Utah County. Yeah, you are the opinionator on the show. What's your opinion?
Well, that is false. I mean, that is just a false statement, because if you wore a mask to protect yourself and you were willing to take the risk, then yeah, it's your choice. But you don't wear a mask to protect yourself. You wear a mask to protect other people. And if we are in a situation where you are not willing to do anything as minor as wearing a mask in order to protect other people, then what you are doing is claiming a constitutional right to harm other people. And no, that is not a constitutional right. Your right to swing your fist ends at my nose. Your right to breathe without a mask ends in my lungs, and you are contaminating people, or potentially contaminating people, if you refuse to wear a mask. And the idea that you have constitutional right not to wear a mask in a global emergency is some goofy idea that has been promulgated on Fox News and the internet, and it's just flat false.
All right. George Pyle is the editorial page editor and a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are going to take a quick break here on Behind the Headlines. And when we come back, we will move north to Salt Lake County, where a different kind of related protest or rally took place. Again, this is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Utah Public Radio and Bridgeland Audubon Society are excited to present the Grow Native for Birds Bookmark Art Contest. All of Utah's wild birds rely on native plants in the wild and in our parks and gardens. And this artist contest celebrates the beauty of this interdependence and connectedness. From now until September 4th, we'll be accepting submissions, and then you'll get to vote on your favorite design. The winning design will be printed on an educational bookmark that will be distributed to Utah libraries, local fourth graders, and online, available for anyone to view and download. For more details, go to upr.org. And to submit, just send your submissions to katie.swain@usu.edu. Celebrate nature and art.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner and by editorial page editor George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Okay, so we spent the first part of the show at a rally in Utah County. Let's come up north. Courtney Tanner, another rally, this one in Salt Lake City. The topic was still school kids, but this rally wasn't about mask wearing so much. At least that wasn't the thrust of this rally. What was it about?
Yeah, so in the state's capital, parents and students were calling on Salt Lake City School District in particular to let kids come back to the classroom in person instead of continuing school online. Kind of the issue there, though, is that Salt Lake City is still in the orange or the moderate risk phase for the virus, and under that status, it's supposed to remain online.
Hmm. Okay, and so, yeah, this risk level says you can't have in-person classes in basically any capacity. And so these parents and these students are at the Capitol. They're holding this rally, and they are saying, look, every other county is going back. Why can't we go back? Is that basically their point?
Right, yeah. So they were outside the steps of the school district, and, you know, students were saying, it's not fair, all the schools around us get to go back. You know, some of them held signs saying, like, there are schools 3 miles away that are just outside of the city limits that get a return, that get to play sports, and we don't, you know. So there were, you know, there were a lot of kids wearing their, like, football uniforms and kids in school colors. I will say everyone there was wearing a mask, though.
And that was a point that you documented from a number of people who were there. And sorry, this is at the school district, the steps of the school district. You corrected me. I had said the Capitol. They said, hey, we would be happy to wear masks. We just want to go back to school. I know, you know, that in-person school is ideal for learning, but isn't it also that the reason this wasn't happening is because we are in this coronavirus hotspot within a hotspot, and so the risk levels are in place to account for that. Before you answer that question, maybe you can break the next bit of news, which is that actually the risk levels have been amended so that Salt Lake City could go back, right?
Right. So Salt Lake City will stay in the orange risk level. It's actually the only spot in the state that's in the orange. That's why Salt Lake City School District is the only school district that wasn't allowed to reopen, and parents were rallying. But yes, yesterday, Governor Herbert rewrote the state's risk levels so that even in the orange, Salt Lake City school districts will be able to welcome students back this fall, along with every other K through 12 district in the state.
What did he say was the rationale behind doing that? I mean, did he say, I guess I'll just leave it at that, Courtney.
Sure. So he didn't go terribly in depth. But, you know, he said that he wants Salt Lake City School District to be able to reopen so that students have the same opportunities as the other schools in the county and in the state. And some of the issues that students have brought up, as I mentioned, you know, being able to play sports was a big one. You know, there are students that are in their senior year and could lose out on, like, athletic scholarships if they don't play, like, their season. And there are students, too, that said, you know, we're up for the same academic scholarships that students are in other districts, and learning online isn't really conducive to getting those, to winning those awards. And so Herbert said, you know, we're doing this so that everyone has the same opportunities.
Okay, a sort of fair playing field. But then again, well, we're in the midst of a pandemic. Let's bring George Pyle again, editorial page editor, columnist with the Tribune in. And George, let's start with the decision from Governor Herbert to change what the orange level risk means for schools. And then maybe we can talk about the bigger picture as well. What do you think?
Well, I think this is another example of our leaders refusing to lead and our governor refusing to govern. I understand the political pressure. I understand that people are worried about missing out on education, particularly people who are going to be seniors this year. But, you know, if orange meant you shouldn't go to school a couple of days ago, and today it means, yes, you can go to school, it just makes it that much harder for people to understand what they should be doing, how much precautions they should be taking, what is the state doing, what is the school board doing. It's hard to keep up with this. I mean, you know, the three of us, we make a living keeping up with this stuff. Other people have other things to worry about in their lives, and they have to kind of rely on official statements through the media to find out what's going on. Changing the rules and moving the goalposts and saying orange means this, no, it means that, but you're still too dangerous not to be yellow, but orange isn't as bad as it was a couple of days ago. I think the governor is being led by the mob rather than leading, which is, in retrospect, I think, going to turn out to be pretty dangerous.
You know, there's also the news that, and this is recent news, that there's this unreleased White House report that says that 18 states, among them Utah, should go backwards on the you know, the reopening front, meaning that they are coronavirus hotspots, and the best action is to further clamp down. I don't know, George, you talked a little bit about this already, but there's been a wide call for the governor to issue a statewide mask mandate. You can see that obviously some people would really reject that. I don't know. This is an interesting time to live in, but what do you think about the mask mandate, George?
Well, I think the governor should have issued a mandate. I think, as I said earlier, you don't want the situation where you have mask police, you know, going around in camouflaging armor, arresting people because they're not wearing masks. And then the answer to that is, well, if you're not going to arrest people, then it isn't really a mandate. But I think it has some psychological weight to say the governor has ordered everybody to wear masks in public and certainly inside public buildings like schools. He is reluctant to do that because he's afraid people won't like it. But, you know, it's a global emergency. He is the governor. He's supposed to govern. And one of the things he should be doing, and maybe he should roll out the doctors to say this rather than himself. But, I think he's been too tentative on this throughout. He kept hoping for a silver bullet from, you know, Test Utah or the Silicon Slopes or something like that. That never materialized. And we're in a fix right now where a lot of valuable time has been lost as our leaders kind of dither about.
I wonder, though, George, if he's maybe playing kind of a careful political game. In that, if he instituted the mandate, there would be this widespread backlash, and maybe that would cause further harm to public health than if he does what he's doing now. I don't know the answer to that, George.
Well, no, yeah. I would imagine that is weighing on his judgment. Yes, he doesn't. It's no fun for a governor or a mayor or an editor or a general to issue an order and nobody obeys it. That just makes it that much harder for you to issue the next order that may be necessary and in the public interest. But there has been, I mean, part of it is not Governor Herbert's fault. Part of it is the world that we all live in, the garbage that's been put forward online, on Fox News, on other places, that this is all a hoax, that it isn't really that serious, that it's just the flu, that young people don't get it, which is all that false. It's just empirically false. And that is the atmosphere in which Governor Herbert has to function. It can't be any fun. But, I mean, I think he should have been more forceful from the beginning. And now, because we weren't forceful enough over the summer when school was out anyway, we're reaping the benefit, the anti-benefit of that right now. It's going to be harder for us to go back to school now because of what we didn't do in the last few months.
Courtney, just going back to, I mean, George brought this up, but going back to the Salt Lake City schools, the governor has changed what's allowed, what can happen. Are Salt Lake City schools going to reopen this fall? I mean, in some capacity?
I think that's definitely the plan. So the school board will readdress the issue at their Tuesday meeting. When they originally were in the orange, they had kind of drafted two plans. So they drafted an orange plan that said, you know, we can't reopen. This is how we move forward with online learning. But they also drafted the second plan that said, like, if we do get moved to the yellow and we can reopen, here's what we do. And that had students going back, it depended if you were in like elementary, middle school, or high school, but going back essentially 1 or 2 days in person and then doing the rest online. So they could just use that plan going forward. They could draft something different entirely, but they'll hopefully address it this week.
Okay, and you will be there to cover it, I'm sure. We may have exhausted the topic of masks here on the show, and I'll just remind listeners again that you can join the conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Courtney, just before we move on from schools and coronavirus, is there anything else you want to add about how different school districts are taking different approaches to the return to the classroom, or is there anything we're missing?
I think that's a good point. So every individual school district is tasked with coming up with their own plan. So there are certain things that will look the same in all of them. They all have to have sanitation. They should all, you know, space desks apart as much as they can. But each individual school district also comes up with its own plan of what, like, the school week looks like, what students are required to do, what options there are for those who don't want to come back. And those are usually posted on the school district's website individually, and they're all due to the governor by August 1st.
And then, Courtney, just before we move on, actually, I'm thinking about this. How, you know, you highlighted the story of the one teacher in Utah County one of the teachers who spoke in favor of of the masks being used in schools there. That's, she wanted to feel more comfortable. How is the teaching community, how are educators feeling about the direction that Utah schools are headed in terms of reopening. Is there a lot of backlash there?
Most teachers are in support of masks. Most teachers that I've talked to, including some in Utah County, most are in favor of it. So there's one teacher in particular that I talked to that teaches at Olympus Junior High, and she's actually a two-time cancer survivor and also has asthma. And she said, you know, we've kind of been told, the district, that the Granite School District has essentially told them, she said, that they can either return to the classroom or take a year off without pay. So for teachers that do feel like they're kind of forced to go back, that don't have an option, you know, a lot of them are saying, like, we're high risk, we're a little bit older than these school children, we appreciate the mask mandate, it keeps us safe.
Hmm. But it seems like they're just having to prepare endless contingency plans as they think about, you know, what they're going to do when schools reopen. And I guess that's just the reality we're living in, and education has to continue one way or another. George Pyle, any comments on that before we move to just one final topic and then a break?
Well, I think, the school districts are in a tough spot. I mean, ideally, people talk about choice. There probably should be some choice in that students or families, depending on the family unit, like are they living with adult parents or grandparents who are compromised in some way, the schools are do everything they can to say, if you don't feel comfortable coming to school, if you would rather stay home, we will work with you. We will help you with that. Families that are well off enough and educated enough to have high-speed internet connections and computers and parents who can help and oversee, that's great. That will take a little bit of the strain off the school. But then you're in the situation where we sort this by socioeconomic class, and that students who don't have high-speed internet connections at home, people who don't have two parents who are college-educated and are used to this kind of thing, and, you know, but even I'm reading, you know, people who write for the New York Times and have advanced degrees and can work at home are having just an awful time keeping up with helping their children stay online and work with different platforms and everything. So even people who are privileged in a way that they can educate their children at home, it's no walk in the park. Mm.
But at the same time, disparities being more pronounced during this pandemic.
Yeah, it just exacerbates the separation that's already there.
Okay. Courtney Tanner, we have just a couple of minutes before we head to a break, and I thought I might ask you if I can talk to you about a story that you wrote that is not as recent as the mask story. It's the story of a high school in northern Utah, Bountiful High. I know you've covered other things since, but this is about a debate over changing the school mascot. And can you just tell us about that?
Yeah. So Bountiful High School has the mascot of the Braves. And recently there was this petition started to change that mascot, and it kind of led to, you know, this kind of uproar and a lot of resistance in Bountiful, which is largely white. So there's been this division. You know, some people are saying that this mascot honors American Indians. The mayor has come out against this woman that started the petition and told her to be, quote, less easily offended. But then, you know, there's another group of mostly Native Americans and then some white students that are saying this is offensive. You know, students go to football games in kind of red face and war paint. They call the kind of opposing team's entrance the Trail of Tears. And, you know, they're saying this isn't really culturally sensitive at a time when the nation is really looking at these names.
Yeah, as we saw the change of the Washington's football team name happening. At one point, the mayor of the town basically questioned whether or not the person who was complaining about this had the right to complain about it because they weren't Native American. Is that correct?
That's right. So the alumna that started it, Mallory Rogers, she is white and she's acknowledged that, you know, and she said that she wants more Native voices in this issue. And she's actually worked to bring those up as well. But when she first sent the email to the mayor, he did kind of respond back. And it's honestly what kind of made this into a bigger issue is his response went viral. But he asked her, you know, are you Indigenous? Are you their official spokesperson? Are you a representative of the Braves, which isn't actually a tribe, but essentially, like, question what authority she had to bring up the issue.
So we will go to a break here in just a brief moment, but is there any update to this story, Courtney? I mean, is there a real movement afoot to change the name, and will it happen?
So the school district said that it's going to look at it. You know, they've kind of cautioned nothing's going to happen overnight, but they are going to look at it. There isn't a policy in place for them to change a mascot, so it is something that they're going to have to kind of revise or maybe put into policy in order to do. But they have kind of started the process to at least look at the mascot.
George Pyle, your comments on this, and then we'll head to a break.
Yeah, I understand that this is fraught with a lot of emotion, and that people say, well, you know, who are you? Who do you have standing? Do you speak for the tribe? That's been the issue with the University of Utah and their Utes nickname. They have an agreement with the Ute tribe where the Ute tribe says, yes, please use our name, and their members get benefits and help going to the university and everything. And so there's an official group of people who sanction this. When you're talking about Indians or Braves or Chiefs or something like that, there isn't anybody you can go to and say, is this okay? I think that people who say that this is not meant as a slur, this is meant to be honorable. I mean, you don't name your team after something you think is weak and stupid. You name your team after something you think is honorable and strong. But some of the stuff that goes with it, the war paint, the trivializing something as dreadful as the Trail of Tears, I think they could work on that.
All right, George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to head to a quick break, come back with our underplayed stories of the week, and then a segment with Tribune reporter Andy Larson. This is Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, it's international pop music. Songs with mainstream appeal from Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, and Europe.
Un principiante che non aveva mai amato un po' distante.
I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for World Pop, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
A limited number of tickets are available now for Writers in the Woods, book signings and presentations by artists in the beautiful surrounding of Northern Utah's natural settings. In July, writer Nicole Walker will share her collections, The Afternormal, Brief Alphabetical Essays on a Changing Planet, and Sustainability, A Love Story, at the Stewart Farm in Hyde Park. Join Utah Public Radio and the Stokes Nature Center in July for Writer in the Woods. Ticket information at upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Courtney Tanner and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And to save some time for a segment with Andy Larson about the long-term effects on some people of the coronavirus, we will turn already to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And George Pyle, let's start with you for a story that you want to highlight that we didn't talk about on the show.
Well, I would commend your attention to a story from Brian Mathley that I guess just appeared online a couple hours ago. Headline is Anti-Wolf Group Goes to Court to Keep Utahns from Knowing How It Spends Its Tax Money. This is just another chapter in this shameful history of the state legislature giving millions of dollars to groups who want to make sure there are no wolves in Utah. By wanting to make sure there are no wolves in Utah, they prove they are biologically illiterate. By not wanting to tell the taxpayers how their money is spent, they prove that they are democratically illiterate. And this is a shame, and people ought to read Brian's story in this morning's Tribune.
All right, George Pyle with a pick about, I'm assuming, Big Game Forever and wolves. Courtney,
yes.
Courtney Tanner, what is your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, our reporter Aaliyah Larson did this fantastic look at Helper, Utah. You know, it was this coal mining town that went bust, and then they turned to the arts. And now with the pandemic, the arts are kind of struggling. So she just paints this really lovely portrait of this town.
Okay, check that out as well. For my part, I'm going to go with a story that the Tribune has covered pretty thoroughly, but that got some additional play this week when Reuters picked it up. It's that there is a pile of radioactive waste sitting in Estonia that might be headed to Utah's White Mesa uranium mill. The decision comes down to whether or not the Utah Department of Environmental Quality okays the deal. Check out the Reuters story, but find Tribune reporter Zach Podmore's event, even more thorough reporting on the topic at sltrib.com, which is also where you can find everything else we've been covering on this show. Courtney Tanner and George Pyle with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
For the rest of the show, we'll turn to my conversation with reporter Andy Larson about the long-term effects in some people of COVID-19. Take a listen. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks again for having me.
As always, a pleasure. Andy, we're going to talk today about what we know and don't know to date about the long-term effects of getting the coronavirus. You broke this into three categories, and you used this amusing, somewhat quizzical framework. I'm going to play the original clip laying out that framework, Andy, so hold on just a minute.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
And Andy, that is, of course, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld talking about the justification to go to war in Iraq, despite the lack of evidence linking that country to a supply of weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. But anyway, it is a useful framework for where we are in our understanding of the long-term effects of COVID-19. And so, Andy, let's start with the
known knowns.
Among these items, how long COVID-19 symptoms typically last. How long is that, and how do we know that, Andy?
Yeah, there's this COVID symptom study. It's this joint project from researchers in the UK and in the US, Massachusetts General Hospital and the King's College of London. And they created this app that's basically asking people to put in what their symptoms are every day when they wake up. So they've had a ton of responses so far, almost 4 million responses in terms of the number of people who are taking part in this. So it's really good data. Most of those people from the United Kingdom. And basically what they're able to do is say, hey, you know, most people have symptoms that do recover with an average of about 10 days. And most people do recover completely within 14 days. What they have found is that they have about 1 in 10 people who have symptoms for over 3 weeks. And those are the people who, you know, we're seeing a lot of stories done and trying to find more about are the quote unquote long COVID people, the people who keep having symptoms for a long time as a result of this.
Right. So there's the typical progression of the disease. And again, 10 to 14 days. And then we also know that for some people, there can be that not so typical progression and some unusual symptoms as a result. Those symptoms are sort of varied. What are we talking about there in terms of what we know for them?
You know, we know about the loss of smell, and that's gotten a lot of pub, and certainly it's something that can happen with other viruses. It's not a huge surprise, but this one does seem to happen more frequently with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
But you know, then you get some ongoing. Basically, you've got the ongoing symptoms from the initial kind of lung infection. So you've got pneumonia, you've got long-term lack of, you know, lung capacity, those kind of things. And then you kind of have the secondary effects from the immune system's response to it. So that's kind of the blood clotting, some of the inflammation stuff that we're seeing in patients. And some of that blood clotting and blood problems can cause things like strokes, things like kidney failure, things like even just blood clot issues that, you know, the Broadway actor, I forget his name, Nick Cordero, I believe, but he actually had to have his leg amputated because of blood clot in his leg before, you know, he tragically passed away last week. So, you know, it's these kind of things that, you know, just because someone does recover doesn't necessarily mean that they're up to 100%.
And so we have to keep an eye on it, and research is being done, and how to maybe ameliorate the impacts is obviously the focus of a lot of medical investigation right now. Well, let's move on, Andy, to the
known unknowns.
Known unknowns, among them, why the people who get those long-term symptoms get them, right? Like, we don't know why it's these specific people.
Yeah, and that's something that we're trying to figure out. You know, I think some of it is there's a lot of immunology that we're trying to figure out in the course of this disease, right? And so is it something about people's immune systems that makes them more susceptible to this over-immune reaction, the cytokine storm that we've talked and written a lot about?
The clotting, basically, right? Part of the clotting.
That's part of what causes that clotting, is that cytokine storm. You know, we also want to know things like how permanent that lung damage is and what percentage of people have long-term pneumonia symptoms because of this. Is this how long do people have, you know, kind of reduced exercise capacity for? We have some data from that from the original SARS back in 2003. But the truth is not that many people got the original SARS compared to this. So we don't know how the different cohorts look. And obviously, it's also just a different disease.
You wrote, Andy, about asymptomatic people who show visible lung damage when you do a CT scan. And then, how long that persists is something we'd like to know, but we don't know.
Yeah, if there's a good news part of this and the known unknowns, it is that in those asymptomatic people, we do see recovery in most of them when we check on them a week later. So they actually have what are called ground glass opacities in their lungs, which prevent some of their lung function from working because, you know, they've been infected. But it does get better if they check on them a week later in something like 70% of cases. So what is it about those 30% of cases that doesn't allow them to recover in a week? And are they better 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 6 months down the road? Are still things that we're discovering and trying to figure out.
Time will tell. This is an interesting one that's part of this category. There are reports that COVID-19 is triggering diabetes. Explain that. Is that true?
Yeah, and that seems to be true. And it can be anywhere from, it looks like, mild to severe cases that are doing this. And while that sounds kind of crazy, you know, we know that diabetes is a pre-existing condition that leads to worse cases of the virus. What we're also finding is that people who weren't previously diabetic are now having diabetes symptoms and are becoming diabetic as a result of this. Now, that sounds bonkers, but it is something that does happen with other viruses at times as well. And, you know, what we're trying to figure out is basically, you know, how many people does this happen for? Again, who does this happen for? And are these symptoms permanent? You know, is it something that once their immune system and their basically body chemistry goes back to normal, are they able to, you know, live everyday lives, or do they continue to need insulin and diabetic injections for the rest of their lives?
Huh. And then I guess there's some questions about mental symptoms, some impact of the virus on the brain. We know it's there for some people. Why and the long-term impacts, that's sort of the unknown in this instance. Of this might have to do with sort of post-intensive care syndrome or hospital psychosis, but can you talk about this, Andy?
Yeah, you definitely do see some of that where people who have been in ICUs for a long time, especially something like COVID, where it is, you know, you're being isolated from your friends and family, is very mentally damaging. And we see that in not only COVID, but other ICU trips as well. But we are seeing kind of neurological symptoms and even some mild cases that end up lasting beyond the 21 days. So, you know, there are a lot of stories of people in these long COVID support groups, people just being extremely fatigued, of them having on and off days of confusion where they don't, you know, can't focus on anything or, you know, whatever it is. And then, of course, you get some more serious neurological symptoms as well, where, you may have some blood clotting issues. You may have hypoxia. The lung damage actually prevents as much oxygen from getting to your brain, right? So, kind of trying to figure out how long these things last. Again, which of these people are more susceptible to kind of these long-term fatigue issues. But there is, you know, a real medical diagnosis here that's happening, and it does seem to happen in a sizable percentage, certainly not the majority or even like a large minority, but, you know, maybe 5 to 10% of the people who have this disease do feel long-term fatigue kind of issues going down the road.
Wow. Well, on to the final Rumsfeldian category.
But there are also unknown unknowns.
Isn't this just sort of stabbing in the dark, Andy? I mean, this category covers the sort of scarier stuff. What are we talking about here, Andy?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's been a lot of coverage and a lot of, I think, worry from everyday people about what this could do, that it doesn't have a lot of connection with what we know about how viruses and especially coronaviruses work in real life. So, you know, certainly there are, for example, viruses like the chickenpox virus that stay in your body for your lifetime and can have later effects. You know, you get chickenpox when you're young, you have shingles when you're older. And as an adult, shingles can be very, very dangerous, whereas chickenpox is, you know, whatever. That's not really been the case for coronaviruses, and there's no real reason to think that would be the case with this one either.
That it would stick around forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not really how these things generally have worked. So there's no reason to, guess, be worried about that unknown unknown. ditto with multiple strains and the crazy evolution and mutation of this coronavirus to be something more dangerous. The truth is, most of the time when viruses mutate, they become a little bit less dangerous, because when you have an extremely deadly virus like, say, Ebola, what you find is that it doesn't spread that well because people don't go out and give it to other people. As I write in the article, dead bodies don't go to bars and restaurants very often. Hmm. So essentially, most of the changes the viruses make, if anything, make them more moderate rather than more severe. So it's these kind of like unknown unknowns that I think people are worried about, like the movie Contagion and having that kind of outcome where we really don't have to or shouldn't spend a lot of time worrying about. We have plenty of known unknowns to worry focus about. On as research scientists.
You conclude by saying, look, don't be terrified by, that specific category. But given the fear about even the known unknowns, take precautions.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, this is something that I think we put these cases into two boxes, right? And actually, the state of Utah does this explicitly. It's either people who have died, or if you haven't died after 3 weeks, you're considered recovered. And the truth is that there is this large swath of people who are not recovered to 100% in any significant state. And sure, they may not be in the ICU anymore, but they're still experiencing long-term impacts down the road, including some pretty devastating ones. So I think it's something to keep in mind when you're kind of making your own internal risk calculus about what kind of actions you're willing to take in this pandemic.
All right. So come on, wear a mask, stay at home, wash your hands, and so on and so forth. Andy, we don't have time to cover some good news that you have that you wrote this week in depth, but can you give us the sort of short and sweet one or two sentence version of where we are on vaccines so that we end on a slightly less terrifying note?
Yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to do, right? Like the long-term consequences is scary, but the good news is we are making significant progress in a number of different vaccines in both new and old vaccine technology. Moderna came out with research yesterday. We've got multiple different really good shots at this thing that it's pretty clear we are going to be getting a vaccine sometime in the next 6 months. Like that's really what it comes down. It would be really surprising if that were not to be the case. And so,
and when you say we, you mean that medical science will have developed the vaccine. It doesn't necessarily mean that in the next 6 months you and I will have it or anybody listening.
Right. And that's, I think there are significant distribution challenges to overcome. And certainly you should expect healthcare professionals and at-risk people getting it first. But progress is being made, which is really encouraging.
Well, some good news from Andy Larson to wrap up this segment. Andy Larson, thanks very much for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks again.
Again, that's Tribune sports reporter turned COVID columnist Andy Larson. Find all of his deep dives on coronavirus at sltrib.com. That does it for Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. A quick note that next week we'll be taking a break because of the Pioneer Day holiday, but join us again soon for more conversations about Utah news. Until next time, I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.
As part of Project Resilience, Utah Public Radio and the USU Center for Persons with Disabilities presents the Mental Health and Developmental Disability National Training Center's Crossroads podcast. In episode 8, Improving Access to Mental Health Services for Young Adults with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Needs. Find this and other episodes by going to our website, upr.org, and linking to our Project Resilience programming.